choose to take their children along rather than leave them behind, a choice that CBP has been known to pose to parents who are being removed. The U.S. government does not expel under Title 42 nor deport American citizens, Diamond wrote. A U.S. citizen departing the country with an alien who has no legal presence and is being expelled or deported would be accompanying that expelled or deported individual. But this rationale falls apart when considering the mother's claims that they weren't informed they were being expelled at all. In order for there to be consent, there needs to be an ask. And none of them were asked whether they would consent to leave their infant child in the U.S. foster care system, said Ramos. It would be interesting for CBP to argue that all of these mothers consented and it was an expulsion because they all have very similar stories. I was told I was going to go to my family. I was going to be released. I ended up in Mexico. I don't know how this happened. The incoming Biden administration has pledged to review the myriad asylum restrictions implemented by President Donald Trump, but has not yet issued a clear timeline or plan. In recent interviews, soon-to-be senior White House officials have hinted that Trump border policy revisions will happen gradually and that there are processing capacity issues that might justify moving slower than advocates hope. Joe Biden's transition team did not respond to a request for comment. The order allows customs officials to exercise discretion and consider humanitarian and other factors when making expulsion decisions. Asked about whether current CBP policy would consider pregnancy or birth medical situations to warrant a favorable exercise of humanitarian discretion under the order, Diamond wrote that COVID-19 now makes any individual arriving at our borders with or without symptoms a potential risk to frontline personnel, doctors and nurses, and the American public. He said that discretion might be exercised when return to their home country is not possible or an agent suspects trafficking or sees signs of illness.
Saudi Arabia, in a U-turn on its diplomatic course, has decided to lift its land, air, and sea blockade on Qatar following more than 3 years of a standoff between the two countries. The decision was announced at a Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit held in the Saudi city of Al Ula. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said the kingdom signed a rapprochement agreement with Qatar along with Oman and Kuwait. The prince, a de facto ruler, hailed the agreement, saying the attending nations reaffirmed their Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability. He also thanked the United States and Kuwait for their mediation. The deal, however, seems to be pursuing nothing but an anti-Iran policy by Riyadh. During the summit, MBS repeated the kingdom's anti-Tehran rhetoric, saying there was a desperate need to unite their efforts to what he called develop the West Asia region and confront challenges, especially those posed by Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile program. The Saudi-Qatar rapprochement comes more than 3 years after Riyadh, along with its regional hawks, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, cut their diplomatic and economic ties with Doha. They sealed their borders and expelled Qatari citizens from their countries. They accused Doha of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. Qatar, however, strongly rejected those allegations, arguing that it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for reconciliation. Qatar, however, did not publicly bow to any of their demands. But what has really caused the Saudi regime to lift this blockade on Qatar and resettle relations with Doha at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump, one of Saudi's main backers in the international coalition against Iran, is leaving office within weeks?
At this point, the Saudi Arabian government knows that Trump is leaving office shortly, and the Biden administration will not be quite as sympathetic to its rogue activities as the Trump administration has been. So for this reason, Saudi Arabia wants to reestablish or at least normalize its ties with Qatar, and that's the reason for them doing this at this time.
While the reconciliation agreement between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is still preliminary in nature, questions arise as to why Riyadh makes a sudden U-turn in its approach toward Doha. Observers say Saudi Arabia is pursuing its own interests.
Saudi Arabia is certainly pursuing its own interests. It isn't acting in the interests of that region of the world or of Qatar, but it does see that the end of the U.S. government's permission to do whatever it chooses is in sight. Also, the Saudi Arabian government realizes that this blockade has not been effective. Qatar has not given in to any of the 13 demands that Saudi Arabia issued when it started this in 2017. So it's been a complete failure. So in order to save face, perhaps, and also to perhaps curry favor with the Biden administration, it is at this time reestablishing these relations with Qatar.
The latest Saudi posture comes in the backdrop of its growing nexus with the Israeli regime. It is no more a secret that the kingdom is seeking to normalize relations with Israel. That came into the spotlight, especially after Donald Trump's senior advisor, Jared Kushner, said a normalization agreement between Riyadh and Tel Aviv was very imminent. Even the recent U.S. brokered normalization between some Arab countries, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco with Israel, could not have been possible without the Saudi blessing. All in all, what looks to be true is the fact that Saudi Arabia is seeking to establish an anti-Iran front to stand against the Iranian influence in the region.
Because of the recent Arab countries that have established ties with Israel, Saudi Arabia would like to see Qatar join them and then have a more unified front against Iran. However, these nations aren't as willing to demonize Iran as Saudi Arabia is, as the United States is. They see, and Qatar would see, any affiliation with Israel as unrelated to its alliance with Iran.
Riyadh has long accused the Islamic Republic of seeking to destabilize the region. But one may question, isn't it Riyadh that has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions? From maintaining its interference in Libya and Bahrain, Riyadh has also imposed a full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen, killing and maiming tens of thousands of civilians over the past 6 years. What one may also question is how far the Saudi regime seeking to expose its hegemonic agenda in West Asia and beyond.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more that we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
These are the words of the U.S. president, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military, and a man that just 4 years ago took a pledge echoed by his forefathers to uphold the law and constitution of the United States of America, and a man that wanted to continue for another 4 years, with Trump essentially asking the Secretary of State for Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, to break the law and find nearly 12,000 votes. The prompt reply from the official was clear: Georgia's results are correct. Trump then went on to explain that voter fraud was a serious crime, and then had the audacity to threaten the official by claiming he was taking a huge risk by breaking the law. Irony at its very finest, it seems.
The ballots are corrupt, and you're going to find that they are, which is totally illegal. It's it's more illegal for you than it is for them, because you know what they did and you're not reporting it. That's a, you know, that's a criminal offense, and you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk.
Is Trump then breaking the law himself by asking for votes to be found?
I think it is a criminal activity. I think he was clearly pressing an a government official to alter the vote count. That would be illegal under federal law and also under Georgia state law. And when the United States says the national laws and the state laws, what are the chances of the federal law being applied to him? Trump can, of course, give himself a blanket pardon for just about everything. Probably will.
Since the election results were announced, Donald Trump has been contesting the figures and making unsubstantiated allegations of electoral fraud, much of which he believes comes from the postal votes cast by voters worried about voting in person due to the COVID-19 virus.
It's essentially, if they did this, which we have no proof of, we have claim after claim after claim with zero proof. Zero.
Trump's behavior has sparked an angry reaction from multiple leading officials, most notably 10 previous defense secretaries of both Republican and Democrat views, who have urged Trump to drop the notion that the election was not fair and accept defeat with grace. Some of Trump's most staunch supporters, however, have continued to attempt to override the decision, with the likes of Ted Cruz and 10 other senators trying to get Congress to reject the clarification of the result due on the 6th of January. Yet even this is being met by resistance from other leading Republicans. Donald Trump has made it no secret of his clear distaste for Iran. The reason? Simply because Iran chose not to conform with the so-called American way, and hence saw the president remove the US from the JCPOA, assassinate Iran's leading military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and place sanctions on Iran that constituted nothing short of economic terrorism. Along with his ailing ally Benjamin Netanyahu, the Trump and Israeli regime have longed to start a conflict with Iran, in particular over the last 4 years with Trump as president. But as his time comes to an end, will Trump use a conflict with Iran in a last-ditch effort to stay in power, a move that would still guarantee nothing?
Well, I don't think so. Trump is a very erratic figure, though. I've been hearing that there's imminent war with Iran for 10, 15 years now, and there have been some nasty acts about that, the sanctions, assassinations. But a full attack on Iran, I don't think Trump will do that. There's too much headwind from the Joint Chiefs, the generals and the admirals. They don't want it.
Yet the U.S. military themselves are very wary about possible actions and decisions taken by Trump, with the same 10 former defense secretaries who told Trump to accept the election result also stating that entering the U.S. armed forces into a military dispute would be dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional. For Iran, however, the departure of Trump spells a victory and an embarrassing defeat for Trump, as the nation stood firmly against the maximum pressure policy, overcame sanctions through national unity and production, and saw leaders, such as Lieutenant General Soleimani, successfully defeat the US-backed Daesh group, paving the way for a retreat of US forces in the region. With Trump having shown throughout his term the ability to make and act on so many irrational decisions, it appears that the 45th President of the United States is truly on the edge of reason and about to leave a legacy of nothing but lies, deceit, and humiliation.
January the 3rd marked the first anniversary since the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy head of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. The strike, which also killed a number of their companions near Baghdad International Airport, was carried out under the authorization of U.S. President Donald Trump. Both commanders were deeply revered and respected in the region, particularly due to their efforts to fight terrorism and their key roles in eliminating Daesh from Iraq and Syria. Events were held in Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere in the region to commemorate and pay tributes to the two anti-terror commanders and demand their revenge.
We've seen even a tweet, a message being sent out by the ex-president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, sending his condolences to the people of Iran and the people, the free peoples of the world, and calling Soleimani a hero of the anti-imperialist struggle. This is the reason that people come out in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine, commemorating the martyrdom of these great men.
In statements made on the occasion of first anniversary of the assassination, Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movements asserted that the resistance front will continue down the same path set by General Qasem Soleimani. People in Iraq also held nationwide rallies as well as a ceremony at Baghdad airport to pay homage to the slain commanders. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of Iran and Iraq's top anti-terrorism commanders in Baghdad. Following the attacks, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of Pentagon's Central Command said last year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The top commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
The U.S. is staying occupying Iraq because it needs to make sure the resources of this abundant land are not going to the liberation of Arab and Muslim peoples from the yoke of colonization and imperialism. And it's also there to make sure there is no natural continuity between the peoples of the region that have been together for thousands of years, the Iranian peoples and the Arab peoples that have coexisted and coagulated their cultures for centuries. So that is what's happening, and the United States will not leave if it doesn't face resistance to its occupation.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
Tensions between Iran and the United States have mounted in recent days ahead of the assassination anniversary of the Iranian top general Qasem Soleimani. But the two sides were at loggerheads for quite some time. In December, the U.S. President Donald Trump accused Iran of playing a role in a series of rocket attacks that targeted the U.S. embassy in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, threatening retaliation. During his 4 years in office, Trump has time and again signaled intentions to launch an attack on Iran. Just last November, after being heavily defeated in the presidential election, Trump was reportedly asking senior advisors about potential options for attacking Iran's main nuclear site. A range of senior advisors dissuaded the outgoing president from moving ahead with a military strike. They warned that a strike against Iran's facilities could easily escalate into a broader conflict in the last weeks of Trump's presidency. Analysts say that Trump could trigger a conflict with Iran to distract from his failing attempts to overturn his election loss and to complicate his successor's plans for the region. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation on his way out the door. Even Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has said that Trump is creating a pretext for war. All this is playing out as Biden prepares to enact his own policies after his January 20 inauguration. Biden, on many occasions, has said that he wants to ease Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran and return to the Iran nuclear deal. These are all the steps that hawks in the Trump administration vehemently oppose. Over the past couple of weeks, the U.S. military has beefed up its presence in the region. In mid-December, a U.S. Navy-guided missile submarine made an unusual transit of the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic waterway between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. Earlier in December, a pair of B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana flew what the military called a presence mission over the Persian Gulf. That flight was repeated a week later, with two B-52s flying nonstop from North Dakota and heading home after cruising over the western side of the Persian Gulf. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, noted that the U.S. increased military presence in West Asia stems from Washington's fear of the consequences of its past acts of mischief in this region. The IRGC commander, Major General Hossein Salami, also vowed harsh retaliation against any aggression targeting the country.
We will respond to any move by the enemy with a harder and reciprocally more resolute blow. This has been proven time and time again. We say the same thing today. We will not spare the enemy and will not leave it alone.
Last week, Iran issued a stern warning to the UN Security Council about the U.S.'s recent provocative moves in the region. In a letter to the Council, Iran's permanent mission to the UN raised the alarm over what it called U.S. warmongering tendencies, adding that Washington must bear the full responsibility of the consequences. The letter also echoed Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif's remarks, who said that Iran does not seek war, but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
The material that Assange and WikiLeaks published contained evidence of war crimes committed by the United States. This is the first time a journalist has been indicted under the Espionage Act for publishing truthful information. Journalists are allowed to publish material illegally obtained by a third person if it is a matter of public concern. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Marjorie Kahn Ryder. This article is published under the heading Assange Extradition Denial Indicts U.S. Prison System but Imperils Journalism. Stay tuned, please, for the details. Julian Assange's legal victory was bittersweet. In a stunning decision, British judge Vanessa Baritzer denied Donald Trump's request for extradition of Julian Assange to the United States, ruling that Assange was at high risk of suicide if he were extradited because the U.S. prison system could not protect him. But at the same time, Baritzer spent most of her 132-page decision supporting the Trump administration's case against Assange, which amounts to the criminalization of national security journalism. So even as press freedom advocates celebrate that Assange has escaped facing charges under the U.S. Espionage Act, charges that carry 175 years in prison, they are also lamenting Barrett's acceptance of virtually all of the Trump administration's attacks on national security journalism. The UK 2003 Extradition Act forbids extradition if the physical or mental condition of the person is such that it would be unjust or oppressive to extradite him. If Assange is extradited to the United States, he would be incarcerated in a US supermax prison and held in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day under onerous conditions, the judge found. Barrett, sir, relied heavily on the written testimony of Professor Michael Koppelman, Emeritus Professor of Neuropsychiatry at King's College London, who diagnosed Assange with recurrent depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Barrett, sir, cited Koppelman's assertion, "I am as confident as a psychiatrist ever can be that if extradition to the United States were to become imminent, Mr. Assange will find a way of suiciding." She noted that other experts corroborated Koppelman's predictions of suicide. The judge wrote, "The detention conditions in which Mr. Assange is likely to be held are relevant to Mr. Assange's risk of suicide." She cited testimony by prison experts as well as mental health experts. If he were sent to U.S., Assange would face incarceration under onerous special administrative measures, leaving him in virtual isolation from all other human beings. Thus, Barrett, sir, found, faced with conditions of near total isolation and without the protective factors which moderate his risk at HMP Belmarsh, where Assange is currently imprisoned, "I am satisfied that the procedures described by Dr. Luc Fleck will not prevent Ms. Assange from finding a way to commit suicide. I am satisfied that the risk that Ms. Assange will commit suicide is a substantial one," Boris, sir, concluded. "I find that the mental condition of Ms. Assange is such that it would be oppressive to extradite him to the United States of America." Boris, sir's decision is ultimately an indictment of the brutal U.S. prison system that wouldn't be able to protect Assange if he were sent there. But Barrett, sir, had no problem with the U.S. government prosecuting Assange for practicing journalism. This is the first time a journalist has been indicted under the Espionage Act for publishing truthful information. Journalists are allowed to publish material illegally obtained by a third person if it is a matter of public concern. The U.S. government has never prosecuted a journalist or newspaper for publishing classified information. The indictment charges that Assange and WikiLeaks obtained and published classified material that Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning had provided to the organization. Many of the charges allege that Assange had reason to believe that the information would be used to damage the interests of the U.S. or used to advantage of a foreign nation. The material that Assange and WikiLeaks published contained evidence of war crimes committed by the United States of America. They published 400,000 field reports about the Iraq war and 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians. They published 90,000 reports about the war in Afghanistan, including the Afghan war logs, which recorded more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had reported. and they published the Guantanamo Files, 779 secret reports about the U.S. government's torture and abuse of 800 men and boys in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. The most notorious release by WikiLeaks was the 2007 collateral murder video in which a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship targeted and fired on unarmed civilians in Baghdad. At least 18 civilians were killed, including two Reuters reporters and a man who came to rescue the wounded, and two children were injured. An army tank drove over one of the bodies, severing it in half. That video portrays the commission of three separate war crimes prohibited by the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Army Field Manual. Jamil Jafar, executive director of the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, told Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! That the point of prosecution of Assange is to criminalize national security journalism. It goes to the heart of what journalists do, he said, protecting confidential sources, communicating with them confidentially, cultivating sources, publishing classified secrets. These are the pillars of investigative journalism, of national security journalism in particular. Jafar provided written testimony at Assange hearing. He noted that in 1973, Harold Edgar and Benno Schmidt Jr. called the Espionage Act a loaded gun pointed at newspapers and reporters who publish foreign policy and defense secrets. If publication of national security secrets violated the Espionage Act, we wouldn't know about the U.S. government misconduct in the war on terror. In his interview with Goodman, Jafar cited the Washington Post expose of the CIA black sites, the torture and abuse of prisoners in Afghanistan and Iraq that the New Yorker and 60 Minutes disclosed, and the warrantless surveillance program revealed by the New York Times. Noam Chomsky said at a January 4th webinar that the Biden administration will now be spared the embarrassment of putting Assange on trial, but at the same time, the threat to press freedom has been strengthened by Barrett's ruling. Chomsky noted that the government always invokes national security when it doesn't want the people to know what they're doing in their name. National security really means the security of the state against its own citizens, he said. Four Blackwater mercenaries committed war crimes when they used machine guns and grenade launchers to kill or wound at least 31 Iraqi civilians in Baghdad in 2007. They were convicted and were serving long prison terms. In a move that fueled outrage throughout Iraq, Trump pardoned all four men. Contrast that with the 2007 collateral murder video, which contains evidence of U.S. war crimes also in Baghdad. The helicopter crew was never prosecuted. Trump pardoned individuals who committed war crimes, but indicted Assange, who revealed them. The U.S. government is appealing to the High Court to reverse Barrett's denial of extradition. If the U.S. loses there, it can appeal to Britain's Supreme Court. The appellate process will take several months. It is unlikely that Barrett's ruling will be reversed on appeal. She limited her decision to a narrow ground, Assange's mental health, and accepted most of the U.S. government's allegations.
this tree.
"2020 is an inflection point. Countless articles, reports, and feature stories have been produced about the unprecedented nature of the year. Top headlines made references to the global pandemic and the ongoing financial crisis. If West Asia were a company, it would have filed for bankruptcy this December, declaring its inability to shoulder losses any further. But unfortunately, it is not a company that can liquidate itself out of existence, but rather a home of millions who have no choice but to carry on with their lives against all odds, putting up with endless wars, corruption, and COVID-19. Hosting some of the oldest inhabited cities in the world, the region today is nothing but a giant museum where people can come to visit the past, but catch no glimpse whatsoever of the future due to constant Western aggression and intervention. The Western war on Syria has come to a closure, but the country is far from being back on its feet as U.S. sanctions ravage the country's economy. Millions of refugees remain displaced both at home and throughout the neighborhood, while entire cities and towns are still in rubble, pounding to dust during the 10-year global war on the sovereign nation. Lebanon is no better shape. The country's cash-strapped economy plunged into free fall in late 2019, resulting in meltdown of its once thriving banking and tourism sectors. The savings of ordinary Lebanese have been reduced to nothing but a number on their checkbooks, with banks unable to restore people's deposits. Then came the port explosion of August 4, 2020, destroying Beirut and killing over 200 people. 4 months later, accountability has yet to be achieved, and none of the wrongdoers have been brought to justice. Iraq, too, was expecting better days ahead with the installing of a new prime minister in mid-2020. Mustafa al-Kadhimi was hailed as a breath of fresh air, promising to address economic woes. However, the continuous American intervention in the country, alongside with the twin shock of COVID-19 and the collapse in global oil prices, led to the miserable condition today. The most acute escalation of all in 2020, though, was the U.S.'s assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, prompting unending tension that might just keep moving to the front of the queue in terms of a key driver for 2021. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Confiscated ammonia nitrate were hoarded between the years of 2013 and 2014 at Beirut's port number 12. They were impacted with a spark of fire. This is the official scenario, produced what possibly is the largest chemical explosion after Nagasaki. Who is to blame, and why are the Persian Gulf media outlets repeating the word Hezbollah every time they want to talk about the Beirut explosion?
With regards to storing these risky materials, I believe that it was out of neglect, negligence, and of course corruption. Because it seems that officials in the state, each was trying to sell this material to one side or another, favored to him. So that's one factor which kept this risky material in the port. Of course, in ill conditions, but there could be also a possibility of a perpetrator who ignited the fire, especially that the port is not well secured and it could be easily infiltrated from outside.
You mean anyone could have walked in?
There is a possibility, yes. So especially with the internet division in Lebanon and with people divided in their loyalties and their affiliations.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a possibility. Why the Gulf media is trying to blame Hezbollah? Because I believe that it's not only the Gulf media, but it's also Western media
mm-hmm.
that is trying to lay the blame on Hezbollah, because the West mainly and its Lebanese allies are trying to capitalize on the event in order to call for international mandate over the port
mm-hmm.
and the airport, and under the claim of neutrality on one hand, and on corruption of any local investigative team that could handle the case, that they don't have trust in any local team. So I believe that they are trying to capitalize on this in order to put the port and the airport under international, let's say, control. And it was also coupled by attempts to shift the role of the UNIFIL in Lebanon in order to give it prerogatives of acting and not as a peacekeeping force, but rather as an occupying force that
mm-hmm.
would protect the borders on behalf of the Israeli entity.
The world is really not in shock by the UAE's betrayal of the Palestinian cause by inking this so-called peace agreement with Israel. However, coming out like this only opens doors to more Arab states to do exactly the same. What do you think will, which actually state do you think will be next to betray Palestine?
First of all, thank you for having me. And second, I wouldn't call it betrayal, because the word betrayal itself, it gives the assumption that the Emirates have had an active role in the struggle beside the Palestinians or against Israel,
mm-hmm.
or have a deep solidarity. So I'm very skeptical using the word betrayal. But having said that, and having seen the path that the United Arab Emirates have taken in the last few years, we know for the fact that the Emirates have been normalizing sport normalization, intellectual normalization, even space normalization in terms of allowing Israeli jets, for example, or even allowing Israeli citizens to have a transit in the Abu Dhabi and Dubai. I think we would have either one Bahrain. One thing, or Oman, which Oman has a long history of normalization with Israel, but it seems that the Bahrain is on the top list of these. Of course, we wouldn't rule Sudan, a new regime, and his appetite to normalize with Israel. But let me stress that Israel is usually normalized with authoritarian and autocratic regimes.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at who are the states that normalize with Israel, I mean states that's not in the surrounding historic Palestine,
mm-hmm.
We would say that the Emirates, I mean, we have high level of authoritarianism there. They are, of course, they have high quality of life,
mm-hmm.
but they don't have freedom of speech. I mean, that the only way that the Emirati could express, for example, their opinion is to stay silent, as many Western journalists have witnessed in the Emirate, as well as on online by just writing emojis and not a single word. So to sum this, I think that we will witness a country that have been normalizing with Israel in sport normalization, political normalization, and such as Bahrain. I mean, we need to measure
mm-hmm.
what the Emirates did, and then we will find out who is the next.
A model of defiance against oppression and injustice, omen of patience and of endurance. There was no act of worship greater than continuing the rising of her brother. delivering fiery sermons in Kufa, in Syria, in Yazid's own Majlis. How do you think this role taken by Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam served Islam?
I think first of all, I'd like to send condolences on Ashura to all of the people watching and to yourselves. But I think the entire epic of Ashura required a second component. It's not just one component that makes the victory. You need to have the component of Imam al-Hussein and the actual stance within Karbala, but also you need Sayyid Zainab and the second Zainabi revolution that actually got the message that was delivered and that was learnt or should have been learnt in Karbala to the wider population and even to us. If Sayyid Zainab had not made the speeches and had the resolve and the strength that she did have, then today you and me probably wouldn't be having this discussion, because Karbala would have just been a blip in history. Sayyid Zainab made sure that Karbala was never forgotten and that the sacrifice of the 72 was always something that was understood by people, that drives people. And of course we know in Lebanon, the idea of Sayyid Zainab and the idea of Imam al-Hussein is one of the key ingredients that resulted in the 2000 ejection of the Zionists from South Lebanon. And of course, it's also one of the things that helped with the 2006 victory. But also with Iran and the Islamic Revolution and our brothers and sisters in Yemen, in Syria, everywhere, it is this fire of Karbala that has been nurtured and that has been strengthened by the lessons of Sayyid Zainab and by the fact that she never once, in the worst of situations, when her two children were killed, instead of, you know, falling down and weeping and everything, she went down into prostration and said, رَبَّنَا تَقَبَّلْ مِنَّا هَذَا قُرْبَانَ, that, oh God, accept from us this sacrifice. Mm-hmm. The same thing when she saw the body of Imam al-Hussein with the head severed and everything on Ashura, she didn't break down. Rather, she resigned herself the same way Imam Hussein and all of these companions and the family had resigned themselves to the fact that this is something we have to do and this life is temporary. And so they said, oh Allah, please accept this service from us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
How did Yemen become the Karbala of our time? To discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Jay Therapel, who is a member of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Thank you very much, Jay, for being with us. Now, what motivated Imam Hussein alayhi salam to leave for Karbala was to make sure that the rule over the nation does not fall in the hands of the likes of Yazid. Now, al-Hussein went out announcing his revolution, which will remain obviously immortal over time, but so that successive generations will be able to draw lessons from the revolution by confronting injustice. How do you see this in Yemen today in comparison to the revolution of Karbala?
Well, this comparison is made by the Ansarullah movement themselves, because there are so many parallels between what they've endured since the victory of their revolution in September 2014 and the events leading up to Karbala. Firstly, Imam al-Hussein never took up arms against Yazid. Rather, it was Yazid that took up arms against Hussein and the Ahlul Bayt, culminating in the massacre at Karbala. Similarly, Ansarullah never took up arms against the former Yemeni government. Instead, it was that government under the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, that took up arms against Ansarullah. Even U.S. think tanks like the RAND Corporation admit that Ansarullah were acting within the boundaries of the laws and constitution, and that the only reason Saleh responded to this political challenge with brute military force in 2004 is because he was being pressured to do so by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. They used military force to combat a political ideology because they knew the Ansarullah movement resonates with millions of Yemenis who mm-hmm. believe their country has been kept artificially poor and reduced to a reserve army of cheap labor for the Saudi economy. Secondly, on the day of Ashura, the Ansarullah movement also remembers its own martyrs, beginning with the founder of Ansarullah, Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, who was brutally murdered along with his family members and followers by the Saleh regime. Finally, in the words of Imam Ali, be like the flower that gives its fragrance to even the hand that crushes it. Today, the same Yemeni army that was sent to crush Ansarullah are now fighting shoulder to shoulder with them in defense of their nation.
Prominent Iranian nuclear physicist Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's name was mentioned multiple times in the presentation in 2008 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear program. Now, such blatant evidence against the Zionist regime of Israel compels the UNSC and the so-called international community, if you will, to condemn this act of terrorism. Do you think that this might actually become a possibility?
Iran doesn't have any expectations. Condemnations really don't do much good when a crime has been carried out. The only way to really make the aggressor refrain from committing similar crimes again is for them to suffer the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
But the European Union, the British, Western governments, none of them condemned it. The European Union called it a criminal act, but there was no condemnation, and there will be no repercussions. If you recall, when the British regime claimed that Russian double agent was attacked in England or poisoned in England, even though he didn't die, they made this a huge issue. And the whole of the EU, the United States, Canada, felt 150 Russian diplomats. Result. In the case of Iran, there's condemnation. And in addition to that, there's no force behind the statements themselves. So Iran is forced with the initiative. Iran will definitely retaliate. But also Iran will reduce its commitments to the nuclear deal as well as incorporate the JCPOA. It retaliates against the regime for the attack, and Iran's reduced commitment to cooperation will be a response to Iran's attack and the difference.
Well, Dr. Mirandi, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Iranian experts to preserve the scientific and technical legacy of the nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and ordered the punishment of his assassins. We all remember the retaliation for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, which shook the American presence in Iraq. What are the prospects of something similar, maybe as a retaliation for Israel, as well as maybe the military presence of the U.S. in the region?
Well, the response to the murder of General Soleimani by the Americans was not the final response. It was a response.
Mm-hmm.
The leader said that that was only one step. So we still have scores to settle. With regards to General Fakhrizadeh, I think the response will be the same. It will be comprised of different components. One component will be lethal, and another component will be a loss of access to Iran's nuclear program and an increased speed
mm-hmm.
in the development of that program.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohammed Mirandi, professor at Tehran University, for talking to us about the prospects of retaliation of what Iran will be possibly be doing against the assassins of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We'll talk in the next segment about how the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is trying to impose its views on the Iraqi government and nation. Well, Nate, Biden must truly understand that Iraq today is different from the Iraq that he knew, especially the one where he decided to present a platform or a plan in the U.S. to divide the country into three semi-autonomous regions. America itself is at a defining moment in Iraq, controlling no territory or very specific territory, having no influence or unable even to intervene in political decision-making process. They are regularly being threatened by the popular mobilization units for a confrontation, especially in the event that the U.S. does not actually abide by the withdrawal timetable set by the Iraqi parliament for them to leave the country. How do you see the Iraqi factions reacting to Biden's plan if he really has it in mind to be implemented in Iraq?
Well, the last time the United States attempted to do that with the referendum in Iraq, Kurdistan province, we saw the response, the immediate response from the government of Iraq, from the factions in Iraq, and even from the government of Iran and Turkey. Within hours of that referendum, all the entrances and exits to Kurdistan were, you know, taken over by the Iraqi army and the Iranian army, and that ended it, that possibility of separation. So the West can dream as much as they want of fracturing Arab societies and countries further, but that plan is gone, long gone. The power to do so that may have existed around World War I, even maybe after the end of the Soviet Union, is gone now. The United States has burnt all its cards, all its games have been played out and didn't work out, and everybody knows these plots and plans by heart. Everybody has memorized what the United States is trying to do, and it's not going to work out.
So you think Biden might actually have another option on the table here?
Well, the option that we see the United States in general, whether it's Biden or Trump in power, is confrontation with Iran. They've tried to fracture the Iraqi society since the 1990s, mm-hmm. and it didn't work out. They tried invading, defeating Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it didn't work out. They tried invading and fracturing Syria, and it didn't work out. So now the only thing that they have in front of them is to have a confrontation with Iran, which is also not going to work out.
This is what I want to talk about, the legacy, especially as you will be in part, as I mentioned, a member of parliament representing Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance, the Lebanese Islamic resistance. How do you think the legacy of the likes of a warrior like Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani has affected the performance of your local Lebanese resistance?
You're totally right, actually. When you see someone who has this self-denial, he is altruist, he sacrifices himself, he works day and night, he never recognizes anything of the halal pleasures of life. He is away from his family, he's away from everything, only to help any oppressed. You know, we know very well, and we all remember the Mount of Sinjar, where Yazidis, actually, they were downtrodden and they were mutilated, they were killed, they were cleansed by Daesh. Who helped them? The Kurds as well in Iraq. All those who shouted for help, the Soleimani ears were there, the Iranian ears, the Iranian ears of the Islamic Republic of Iran, of this revolution, of the oppressed, was there to help people everywhere in the world. We all remember here in Lebanon, we remember Bosnia and Herzegovina when the Iranians helped there. We remember Palestine, we remember everywhere. That's why the kind of legacy and heritage, even if we are working now in the parliament, some may be working like yourself or others in the media front, in the social media, all kinds of media,